This is On Target St. John's, a look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know? The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
And good afternoon, everyone. Linda Swain on Target St. John's, and anybody who knows me knows that I love a political conversation, and that's what prompted me to invite in my two guests today. We have two former politicians in studio with me today, one provincial and one federal. They are none other than former provincial PC cabinet minister Keith Hutchings. Hello.
Hi, Linda. How are you?
Good. And former NDP MP, Ryan Cleary. Hi.
Hi, Linda. Thank you for the invite.
And broadcaster and journalist and former provincial cabinet, provincial
Union
candidate.
Leader.
Yes. And the whole Fishanell thing. I know that, too. So welcome this afternoon, gentlemen. And the reason why I got you both in here is because you've been there and done that. And these are very interesting political times. Of course, it's always interesting in politics in Newfoundland and Labrador. But we're in some really unusual times right now. We have Premier Dwight Ball, who just announced that he is intending to resign. He's going to stick around, he says, until a new leader is in place. But the questions have already started getting raised. About whether or not he should have stepped down and appointed an interim leader while the leadership race gets underway. And Keith, I'll start with you. What do you think? What do you make of it all? Should he have stepped down completely and stepped aside and allowed someone else to run the shop until we have a new leader, or does that create even more instability?
It's an interesting question. In regards to the instability issue, I mean, when you look at the context of running a government and the budgetary process, I mean, that starts in the fall, November, December, of departments rolling up their budget requirements and initiatives, and then that rolls into the new year and getting preparatory work done for the budget. So, I mean, the Premier, so shortly after a general election, when he did win a minority government, would be in a process now, and they would be in a process, certainly the bureaucracy and the public service, of putting together that budget and getting ready with the legislature opening in early March to hit a date to certainly roll that out to the people of the province. What you have now is a Premier who's decided that he's not going to carry on, but he's going to be, stay on until a new Premier is appointed, or they go through the leadership process or whatever they determine. I guess it rests with those in Cabinet and caucus in regards to support for the Premier. It does give some, continuity to his leadership and being there. But then again, the other side of it is, if you decided you don't want to do the job anymore, should you basically say, thank you very much, I've given my service, move on, and have someone come in on an interim basis to lead that process I just talked about? There's some relevance of that as well.
Your thoughts, Ryan?
I think it's pretty much a lame duck government either way. Dwight Ball is going. It's just a matter of time. And then you'll have a new leader, a new Liberal leader, and they'll have a year to call an election, but this is a different scenario with a minority government. So in a minority government, it's from my perspective, with the situation we have now, it's either way, it's a lame duck government. So there we are.
Timing is everything, of course. A budget coming down now in a couple of weeks, I would imagine. The legislature opens in March. Is that what may have, played into his decision-making process?
I think it was cumulative. You go back and look at 2016, and the new government came in, and some of the things they originally outlined in the budget at that time, and the then finance minister, and what they wanted to do in terms of some fiscal restraint, and that seemed to went askew, and it didn't carry through with it. And some of the things that happened over a period of time, I mean, they started then talking about getting back the surplus in 22-23. No one really believed in that. The bond rating agencies didn't. The Auditor General of the province didn't. A couple, that position changed, and neither believed we could get there. So it became an issue, I think, of credibility and people believing in the plan that was put before them. And that rolled into some of the things that happened over the past year in regards to appointments, in regards to contracts being given out, in regards to, canopy growth and some of those issues. And I think it's very cumulative where it got to the point now. You had a majority. You lost that majority in the last general election. You went went to a minority. There's a leadership review coming up in June. You know, it was interesting in the news, I heard two cabinet ministers today saying there wasn't much discussion. Well, from my experience, I can tell you there's a lot of discussion. That discussion never ends in terms of leadership, where we're to, are we going to run again, how are we looking for the next general election, how's the leader doing? So I think all of that, at that point in time, you know, the Premier, no doubt, all these caucuses and all these cabinets, somebody spoke to all of those and said, where are we to? Where are you to with the Premier? Can you support him? Will you support him? And I think the message came back that at this point in time, based on Kilmacy, everything that's happened over the past the rough 4 years, he didn't have the confidence of cabinet and caucus to go into, and the party, into a June review. He saw that writing and basically concluded, it's time for me to go.
Rate mitigation, the rate mitigation announcement that was so eagerly anticipated by many Newfoundlanders and Labradorians came up short in a lot of ways. Not a lot of detail there. In retrospect, was that a swan song, Ryan, or what do you make of the rate mitigation announcement made?
I don't make much of it at all. There was no announcement. Just because Premier Dwight Ball says there is rate mitigation doesn't mean there is rate mitigation. There were no details. There is no money from the feds. People just see it as just more of the same, which is there's no depth to it. There's no substance. There's no dealing with the issues. There's just political speak, which ultimately says nothing. So
what does that mean then?
With rate mitigation, I don't know what it means. I have a real fear for the future of the province in terms of how young people see the future staying here. Not a lot of people have a lot of hope. I've considered leaving myself. I'm not going to leave, but I've certainly considered. I think everybody out there in Radio Land has asked themselves in the last few months is, why am I here? Why should I stay here? Should I leave? It's only going to get worse. But in terms of rate mitigation, you're hearing a lot of national columnists, for example, and I've heard some conversation for this morning on Paddy Daly saying, you know, why should the federal government bail out Newfoundland and Labrador, all this kind of stuff. What I can't get past in terms of rate mitigation is the reason why one of the biggest failings of our confederation with Canada is the absence of a fair energy policy. Going back to the 1960s with the development of the Upper Churchill and the fact that we couldn't wield electricity from Labrador across Quebec to markets in mainland Canada or United States because Quebec had us by the throat. So when people talk about rate mitigation, should the federal government step in, the fact that we haven't had a fair energy policy has screwed Newfoundland and Labrador right from Confederation Day One from my perspective. That needs to be addressed.
And I think the other thing, too, Ryan points out, is that, you know, all the water that's flowed from the Upper Churchill and all the energy that's been generated, that's been put into Quebec and down the Eastern Seaboard. That has reduced greenhouse gas emissions for the mass since back then. Muskrat Falls, again, wherever you stand on it, with that energy, that hydro energy being produced, will again reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So when the federal government agreed for the loan guarantee, they called it a regional or a national project, which it is. And when you look at places like Nova Scotia and New Brunswick that have 60% of their energy coming from coal-fired energy and production, I mean, that needs to be taken out. So this is really a regional project with regional implications, and what we've done in terms of getting to 98%, in terms of hydro development, that had huge implications, has had huge implications, and will continue to in regards to greenhouse gas emissions. So, you know, it is national. The federal government does play a role in it, and so they should. And, and you'll hear the national commentary now, and, I heard someone on with Paddy Daly this morning, the guy that wrote that article, and he talked about, not a bailout. Well, it's not a bailout. You're a partner in this, and you decided to be a partner, and there's regional and certainly national implications for that. And when you compare it to what's happening out west in regards to buying pipelines, what's the difference? You support national projects, and you're part of it, and you should be part of it.
You know, when it comes to that loan guarantee, the federal loan guarantee, one of my big regrets, looking in hindsight, my time as a federal MP, is the fact that there was no debate in the House of Commons about a loan guarantee for Muskrat Falls. In my case, as an NDP MP, the party made a decision that they would leave it to the provincial NDP, for example, to debate the merits of Muskrat Falls. So there was no debate in the Commons. I've always had a regret about that because I had no hand in that decision. The decision was made higher up. This goes back to the whole topic about politics and whether or not we need to do things differently. But there was no debate in the Commons. And again, in hindsight, that's a big regret from my part. But I had no hand in the decision.
Ryan Cleary and Keith Hutchings, my in-studio guests this afternoon. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're back. My in-studio guests this afternoon are Keith Hutchings. He's a former provincial PC cabinet minister, you may recall, and Ryan Cleary, former NDP MP. And we're talking about politics and the political situation in Newfoundland and Labrador, and I wanted to get some guests in who have been there, lived the life, done what they could do, both on a provincial government basis and behind the scenes as well. And in opposition. And no one has come forward yet, but will it be hard to find a candidate to take over the leadership of the Liberal Party right now?
I find the dynamics very interesting in the fact that when the Premier decided to leave, he sort of indicated that, by the end of April, they want to have somebody in place. So it seems like they're setting pretty defined periods of time to have someone come in to do the replacement. When you hear that, it kind of indicates, well, maybe there's somebody preordained to do that from the outside, which is interesting because usually this process, takes some time. You'll call the leadership, you go through a period looking for nominations, you conclude the nominations, you'll have some public engagement in regards to having the debates around the province. Then you'll set a time for an actual convention. People will vote, and then you'll have your new leader. So that's quite interesting. In regards to coming forward, there's no one in the front bench yet, I think, that's decided that they would take on the nomination or take on the leadership role. We heard some rumors from outside. It's always good, I think, to have a mix. I think it's always good to have a leadership contest. So we'll see whether others will step up inside or whether it'll be people from the outside that will step forward.
Do you think it might be preordained? Ryan?
I think a lot of the debate has been about who is the next one, be it a man, and then the debate is also more women need to be in there as well. So who is the next one? You know, Newfoundland and Labrador has a bit of a messiah complex. We always look for the next one, but that has never worked out. What I'd like to see is a lot more, not debate so much as who is that person? Who is that one person that pushes over the top? I think we need more debate about policy. I'd like to see a platform that someone stands on and they can... remember when I ran with Keith with the PCs in the 2015 election, one of the reasons that I ran is because Dwight Ball, his party, he was running, they basically had no platform. He didn't need a platform. People were tired of the blue team, and they wanted another team in there. So what I want to see now is an actual platform. I think that in the position that Newfoundland and Labrador is in right now, in our financial circumstance, which is pretty similar to the early 30s when we had responsible government, we had to give that up for the commission of government. I think we're pretty close to that. When you have mainland media or whatever talking about bankruptcy, about Newfoundland needing a bailout, I think that everybody has got to get the message that things need to change. So I would like to see a party, I'm not even sure if it could be one of the mainstream parties, with a platform, be it about the fishery, be it about energy, but with hard and fast policies that people know what they're voting for. It's not just voting for someone because you're sick of the other crowd.
Arguably, and the pendulum has always been swinging back and forth like that, and occasionally it'll go towards, somewhere towards the NDP or something like that, and we've seen that federally in particular. But, is there any real difference in ideology between the main parties? I mean, people will often say the NDP, have a very distinct ideology, but between the Liberals and the PCs, is there any real, substantial difference?
Well, Ryan makes an interesting point, and I think it's all tied into your question in regards to having that discussion on policy and be definitive about what that policy is and what the end result is. The other component is that we need to have, I think, a serious reality check here in the province. People want to see things done differently. You know, you look at the vast geography that we have. We have the fastest aging population in the country. We have a decreasing population. But we're delivering services at a cost that really we can't afford. So, you know, we did it too, and the current government talks about attrition. Attrition is fine, and it's a way to, I guess, reduce costs, but it's not addressing service delivery models. And we really need to start to talk about that here in the province. What service are we delivering? How do we deliver it? Can we deliver it differently, or can others deliver it? When you look at healthcare, you look at transportation, all of those are huge components and costs to what an excess of $8 billion budget is. And we need to have frank discussions about that. How do we deliver the healthcare to various regions of the province? How do we deliver it different? And, you know, people will say when you discuss with them, yeah, we need to make changes and we need to reduce it, expenditures here or somewhere else. But when it comes in their area, or comes to their part of their world, it's, no, we don't want to do it. So it gets to your question about ideology and what political parties offer in a campaign. Do they really tell people what the reality is, or do they tell people what they think they need to say to get elected? And that's where, if everybody's not buying in and being in tune with what's happening in the province and want to have that discussion, that real discussion, that's what needs to happen. Now, is that naive to think that that's going to happen? I don't know. But where we're to, and some of the comments Ryan has made, that's where we got to get to. And that's where policy comes in. You state that we can't provide all the services and how we're providing them today. So how do we deal with it? Just increasing revenues is not going to really solve the long-term problem of per capita spending on various services that we provide to people in Newfoundland and Labrador.
You've both been there. You've both knocked on the doors. Do you learn much doing that? I mean, do people actually want to have these debates and have ideas that they share with you?
I want to bring up one point first in terms of political parties. A problem for Newfoundland and Labrador when it comes to the Liberals, when it comes to the Progressive Conservatives, or even the NDP, is the fact that the federal party and the provincial party are all one. So the policies of the national party are the policies of the provincial party. From my perspective, that doesn't work. What may work nationally may not work as a policy for Newfoundland and Labrador. So I think there needs to be a division between federal and provincial parties right off the bat. In terms of revenue, Keith is absolutely right in terms of if you're running for politics and you say, I think that we need a cut in the public service, for example, I think that, or healthcare, it's too big. We've got to refine our model. You're not going to get elected. So people want truth, but you give them truth and you pay for that truth. In terms of revenue, for example, I think that we need a whole new deal with the Government of Canada. Fishery, now that's always been my passion. But with fishery, for example, one thing Chess Crosby has talked about is an Atlantic Fisheries Accord, like the Atlantic Accord for oil and gas, that makes Newfoundland and Labrador the principal beneficiary of oil and gas. We need that for fisheries. We can't have a future of a fishing province unless we have a sound foundation. And we don't have that now. We need to fight that fight to grow up as a people and a province. And to have that revenue stream in perpetuity for the fish, just fisheries as an example, leading into the future.
We talk about making the tough decisions. Does the electorate want us to make those tough decisions?
Well, that's an interesting question, Linda. And you know, where we're to in the province, and I think we're getting there. I think there's a realization of where we're to today that we need to make that decision. But I think, you know, all partners in Newfoundland and Labrador need to come together collaboratively. And you know, I remember when years ago the Canada Cup was on, and Mike Keenan, I think, was the coach, and he said he brought everybody in, the coaches, and he said, you got to leave your ego at the door. You know, and when people come together, they got to leave not only ego, but who they represent and the clientele they represent, and come together and say, let's have a broad-based discussion, and let's not bring each agenda to the table, but let's just have a discussion, a policy discussion of maybe how we can do things differently. You know, what can we do, or what can we talk about that we're not talking about today? And that discussion needs to be had. And you know, it needs to be broad-based, and, you know, unions need to be part of it, employers need to be part of it, nonprofit groups need to be part of it, those in healthcare need to be part of it, but you can't come to the table with an agenda and say, we can't talk about that, that's off limits. Nothing can be off limits, because you learn when everybody put down their guard and you have a broad-based discussion on a whole range of issues and come to some consensus. Everybody's not going to agree, but you may learn from that and go in different directions that we need to certainly go to in the province.
You know, years ago, I ran a newspaper called The Independent, and the last thing I would do every week before the paper was put to bed is I'd write my column, my opinion piece. And before I'd even start my column, I'd ask myself one question, and this goes back to what Keith was saying. The question I'd ask myself before I wrote my column was, what am I afraid to say? You know, we cannot be, we've got to lay everything on the table. We've got to be able to speak about things without fear of repercussions, about the public service, about service delivery.
About healthcare.
Everything. You've got to be able to lay it on the table, and you've got to be able to speak about it without fear. But now, right now, the way it works in politics is there's fear.
Yeah.
And it's a real fear, because you will pay a price. Your family will pay a price. It's not, I mentioned this to you earlier, Linda, but it's not like years ago where if there was bullying, for example, if you were a kid in school, you were bullied, you go home, and you'd have that safe, that the safety of your home after school or on weekends or in the evenings. But with social media, it's unending. It never ends. It never stops, and it can be absolutely brutal, not just on you, but on your family. So, I mean, I know you're going to get to this question, I'm sure, but people have to really think hard about getting into politics.
Well, and we'll explore that right after this. My in-studio guests, Keith Hutchings and Ryan Cleary, will be back.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're back. My in-studio guests this afternoon, Keith Hutchings and Ryan Cleary, both former politicians and with long, Ryan in particular, long histories in a number of areas. But I wanted to get you in to talk a little bit about politics from that perspective, from your previous perspective in elected public service. And Ryan, you raised the topic earlier about fear. And one of the questions that before you guys came in, I asked you, you know, what motivates a person to enter politics and what should people really be aware of when entering politics? And you mentioned the fear. Has that changed? Are things worse or better now than they have been in the past when it comes to, you know, really putting your neck on the line?
Well, like I said before the break, years ago, you were a politician. It was like a school, a kid in school. You went to school years ago before cell phones, before social media. If you were bullied at the end of school, and in the evenings, on the weekends or whatever, you went home, you had a reprieve. This was your safe place. But now with social media, it's never ending. And if you make a misstep, if you misspeak, or if you say something that's not popular, you've got to be prepared for what could be an absolute avalanche. Now, in the past, I've said things that have been controversial, and I'll probably continue to do that. But people have to be aware that there's a price. That social media, it can be an absolute avalanche and devastating, not just to you, but to your family. What has to drive you, what drives me, is a passion. I look at Newfoundland and Labrador as in it's not in a good place. I think that we could be a hell of a lot better off than we are. We should be. I've heard politicians going right back to Peckford. I wasn't around in Joey's day, saying that, you know, have not will be no more. You know, we should be so much better than we are. Well, I really believe that that we can. And it's that passion that has to drive you. But at the same time, you've got to be aware that there are repercussions if you say something that people don't like.
And it's, you know, it devolves into personal attacks, because I think most politicians, you know, have a strong enough back to deal with, okay, I made this policy decision, you don't like it, all right, I'll take my lumps, but I stand by what I've done. But then it gets into, well, I don't like your face, I don't like how heavy you are, or how
hair.
Light you are, or how tall you are, or your absence of hair. I'm not going to go there, I'm going to leave that alone. You know, when it comes to that level of debate, because I was at a news conference a couple of years ago when Kathy Bennett, who was finance minister, and she had brought down a pretty tough budget, and of course she was taking the slings and arrows from that, but the level of discourse had devolved to such a level that it was quite shocking, the kinds of things that she was subjected to. And it's hard to slough that off, isn't it, Keith?
It is, and just on that note, as I mentioned before, I served in the House of Assembly with three female leaders. Premier Dunderdale, the leader of the opposition, was female, as well as the leader of the NDP. And I saw at that point just, you know, Premier Dunderdale, some of the negativity towards her, which, you know, some of it was based on policy, which you can accept that and have that debate, but some was based on being female, and I think went to an extreme that wouldn't have happened if it had to be a male. So when you look at female involvement in politics, I mean, certainly there's a concern there in how you're perceived and how you're treated. But from a broad-based perspective, I think it's an issue, as Ryan mentioned earlier, about ideas and how we have that discussion. And it's about skill sets and bringing the right people and encouraging the right people to come forward. Having said that, even with my 12 to 13 years in politics, I saw a huge change in social media from when I started to when I left. And, you know, it's you almost got to try and buffer yourself from it to do your job. Certainly as a cabinet minister, as an elected MHA, it's a great tool to engage and to interact with people. But then again, on the negative side and the sinister side, there's a lot coming at you, and there's negativity in that way. And as I've already said, you don't get into politics alone. You get in with your spouse or partner or with your kids or with your grandmother or the people around you. They hear it all too. And, you know, they love and respect you, and they just see you as, you know, you're who you are. And it's hard on them. And probably it's harder on them in some respects than it is on you, because you're living it and you're dealing with it. And but for them, it's tough. So, but, you know, on the other side, you know, we need people to step forward. I certainly enjoyed tremendously my time in politics. You know, you do get a lot of return from it. You know, you get to make changes in your community, in your district. You get to be involved in significant decision making. You help people one-on-one. You know, that may sound a bit trite, but, you know, I really enjoyed helping people one-on-one when nobody else knew about it, but you were able to take a call or stop in to see somebody who was in a tough spot. And a lot of times, maybe you couldn't get to see it through, but you did get to help them, or you didn't, but they appreciated it. And Ryan can probably, you know, certainly share some of that. You get real satisfaction some of that. So I'd encourage people to really think about getting involved, because we need good people. And there certainly is satisfaction from it, and it can be enjoyable.
Is that a big part of it, that face-to-face with the constituent?
Absolutely. I think it's often been said that all politicians get into politics for the right reasons. They want to help people.
Yes.
From my perspective, Keith, I know you'll agree, there's no better feeling than someone comes to you, a member of parliament or an MHA, they have a problem and they have a point, and you help that person. You get them the help they need, and, you know, please God, you do get them the help, and, you know, you don't just try, but you actually, they get the help that they need. There's no better feeling in the world than that. I think that's what, you know, with all the scandals that we've heard in recent months, be it about the rooms or the liquor corporation or the graft, and I made the point earlier, reminds me of the 1930s, not that I was around then. You talk about a certain vintage. Reading back then of the state of responsible government leading up to commission government, you know, people have to realize that we are, from my perspective, we are pretty well at that point. We're at the point where, again, people are talking about bankruptcy or you need to be bailed out or whatever. We need people to come together. And this is what I like about the Newfoundland Alliance, for example. Some of it doesn't make sense to me in terms of how 40 different people with 40 different minds come together to make anything work. But we've got to find a way so that if you're elected to politics with a party, no matter what party you're with, that you can still speak your mind, not just in caucus sometimes, but also outside caucus. We have caucus meetings, or I used to have caucus meetings. You go in and you have it all out. But some of those conversations should happen in public, in your riding, with your people. That needs to happen more, because I said this as well. When I was a politician, when I was a federal MP, I was often asked, well, what did you miss about life before politics? And like you said earlier, I was a journalist. Linda, what I missed most was freedom.
Very interesting. And it leads into my next question, because we're talking about the leadership of the Liberal Party right now. So to what level does a party leader set the tone for a government? You've both served under very charismatic and memorable leaders. To what level do they set the tone? And is it their way or the highway? Or is there room for debate among party members to get a job done?
Yeah, I think it varies based on the personality and the style of that individual leader. I mean, you know, he can have the very controlling leader that everything flows through that individual, demands loyalty, and if there's no loyalty and are not going to do the things that he or she wants you to do, well, you're not part of the team, and you'll sit in the back bench, and that's where you'll be. And then you have other leaders that would be far more engaging, would bring you in and want your thoughts and off your constituency and off certain policies and being part of certain, you know, committees and all those kinds of things. So it varies. But, you know, I think we need far more discussion. And one of the things, you know, the word democratic reform is talked about. And I know as when we were in government, I served as the deputy house leader and in opposition served as the opposition house leader. But there's a lot of constraints and restrictions in the parliamentary process in regards to having that debate and government having a lot of control in regards to the activity in the legislature. And I think that goes to transparency, more discussion, more debate. I mean, we're probably one of the few jurisdictions that don't have parliamentary committees per se and really use them to the extent that we should in regards to, not for all legislation, but specific legislation that, you know, would go out to members, to a committee to be discussed. You could bring in, have witnesses, you know, that part of it really brings a transparent and understanding and input and engagement from the general public. And I think that's what the public want. And I think if somebody could articulate that and how you would do it, and that's only one form, but many forms to do that where people have their say. Now, at the end of the day, a governing party or a premier or a cabinet has to make decisions, and they still need to make those decisions. But they make them as informed as they possibly can be with people giving input. And then after 4 years, the public decides, is this the direction we want to continue going in? And do we respect the decisions they made? And I think that's how it needs to work.
Members of a party have much of a say when it comes to, I know we talk about cabinet privilege and all of those things, but you've been there, Keith, you know, when a leader says this is how we're going to go forward, is there room for that debate without being ostracized?
Well, to Ryan's point, there's room for the debate in the cabinet room or in the caucus room, but then once a consensus is, you know, is determined or the leader decides we're going in a certain direction, I mean, you have a decision to make. You know, if you're in cabinet, you have to support the government of the day in the direction you're taking. If not, you need to step out. If you're in caucus and it's something significant, you know, again, you need to make a decision to make. But, you know, in the overall scheme of things, that's like any organization. That's like, you know, the private sector. It's like community groups. It's like recreation committees. I mean, if you're going in a direction, you collectively have to support it. But I think the real point to what you're suggesting is that people need to feel that they're unrestricted in having their say and they can bring the concerns of their constituents forward or those that they represent. And sometimes that's inhibited. And that's the issue we have at times. And Ryan mentioned before about speaking publicly about things that maybe government is doing. You know, we need a mechanism to be able to do that, and people need to have their say. But at the end of the day, ultimately, you know, government's got to govern. And then they go to the people and ask for their opinion of how they've done. And that's never going to change.
We need to expect more as people. You know, we need to take a good look at parties or politicians. It's not just how they look. You know, do they look the part? Looking the part is one thing, but what is their platform? What do they stand for? Now, like I said, back in 2015, when the Dwight Ball government was first elected, he didn't need a platform. That's part of the reason why I ran. People were tired of the blue. They wanted a different color, and they got a different color. In terms of, I remember one of the questions when I got to Ottawa, you talk about committee work, for example, and committees. And Keith makes a great point. Committees are a great way to bring about a certain issue and really debate it in public or within the committee. But what I didn't like about committees in Ottawa, and I was always a member of the Fisheries and Oceans Committee, obviously for the NDP. But even before our committee would take a study, let's say it was about aquaculture, fish farming, the party would have a stand
before the study was started. So every question that you asked had to be slanted towards the party stand, which was taken before you did the study. So, and then this comes back to leader. I've had two leaders when I was in Ottawa, Jack Layton, for example, who would seek out your input as an individual versus Mulcair, and they both had strengths and weaknesses. Mulcair, who was more, well, buddy, you're going to do what I say. Hmm. You know, so it does come down to style, like Keith says. One of the questions I always asked in Ottawa was, is this the hill you want to die on? Well, buddy, I'll tell you what. I wanted to die on most hills because if you keep letting things go or whatever, you slowly lose yourself anyway.
Is it important to know these things heading in?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's a huge learning curve coming into the elected life. And for me, I'd been involved with the Progressive Conservative Party from my days at Memorial when I started there. So I had that sort of party understanding and involvement and knowing some people and following it. But even still, it's always good to have people to come in and join a party at a particular time and run for election because, it gives diversity to it. People with different views, different perspectives, and that's always refreshing. But people need to understand that certainly there's challenging times in regards to running for elected office and if you get elected. But as again, I say it is rewarding and it can be, you can do things that that you're proud of and enjoy it.
Keith Hutchings and Ryan Cleary, my in-studio guests this afternoon. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
My in-studio guest this afternoon, and it's a really fascinating conversation, I have to say, Keith Hutchings, former provincial PC cabinet minister, and former NDP MP Ryan Cleary. And we've been talking about politics and what motivates people to get involved and what you should know before you enter the political realm, because there's been a lot of discussion about that lately. What about electoral reform? Is it necessary? I'll start with you, Ryan.
Definitely. Right off the bat, I would like to see the elimination for the next election, whenever that is, of corporate and union donations gone. You know, the bottom line is a corporation, both could have the same type of sway over a party. There's no difference, union, corporate donations. I think that needs to be eliminated. You just need contributions from people. That's the very first thing that needs to happen from my perspective, electoral reform, the same as the feds.
Is that influence perceived or is there...
That's real.
It's real.
That's real. That's real. When I was a NDP MP and we were looking at a policy, for example, one of the things that bothered me was the fact that I would be told, I would ask, well, what's the party stand on this? And then the party would tell me, well, why don't you go back and ask the FFAW what their stand is? And then, we're pretty well good to go. That doesn't work. You know, the unions, corporations, there's no difference in terms of their influence. And it has to change. It has to change right away.
Keith?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, if it's legit or perceived, I mean, either way, as the federal government, as the feds do now, Elections Canada, it's individual contributions. I think that's the way to go. In regard to electoral reform, I mean, there's many things we can do. We talked about earlier about parliamentary committees and certainly that engagement piece. I think we need to look at Parliament and how it works here in this jurisdiction and things we can free up to make people on all sides have more input into the legislature and bills that go through, amendments and all of those things and how that input can be put in as well. The other thing that I mentioned earlier too is we had to be careful. Our system, we're probably one of the greatest countries in the world, and our system does work. We have a democracy, and it works well, and we often need to tinker with it. But, this still comes down to one person, one vote. And as the electorate, I mean, the electorate is in control. I'm always baffled sometimes by those that say, well, we don't have influence. Well, you always have influence, and it's how you engage to use that influence to make sure that your views and the people you want to represent you are elected. And it comes down to the voter as well. You know, looking at people that have a certain skill set, who do you want to elect? Can they represent you? Do they have the skill set that you think that they can bring to the legislature? And that's in the control of the electorate. And when people perform well, you know, you re-elect them. If they don't perform well, well, I guess there's an issue about, are you going to re-elect them or not? So it really needs, it's all about, too, electoral engagement, too, in the process, what's happening, decisions are made. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, it's one person, one vote, and the electorate does have authority, and it can, if they are engaged, make changes and do what's needed.
Are the politicians listening, Ryan? It sometimes surprises me as a journalist. We'll put out somebody's concern about something, either it comes up on Open Line or somebody calls the newsroom independently, says, we have this problem here. And it usually not very long before it's resolved. Not all the time, but it surprises me to the frequency in which it's usually resolved. Are politicians listening?
Politicians listen to everything. They listen to the media, the social media. Most politicians worth their salt. They have their finger on the pulse. But getting back to the Keith's point, in terms of we need to demand more from our politicians. This goes back to the voter, to the people. You know, it's not just voting for someone based on how they sound and how they look. Newfoundlanders and Labradorians must demand a better look at policy. What do you stand for? What will this party do for the fishery, for energy, for healthcare delivery, for whatever? We have to demand platforms, and the parties stick to those platforms. That's what, from my perspective, we need to see more of.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And, you know, people need to be fully engaged. You know, it's their province. It's their future. I know myself, Ryan, I have two people in our family, 22 and 20, you know, going through post-secondary, getting to a point now where they're looking to get employment. You know, as parents and as Newfoundlanders and Labradorians, we want them to stay here. We want them to invest here. And as I said before, with the fastest aging population in the country, when us folks move on another 10 or 15 years, there's people need to be here to pay taxes, to pay for those services that we need to run our province. So, you know, that's probably one of the biggest challenges we have now in our province is growing that that portion of our population, that youth. You know, we certainly need a strong immigration strategy. We need to grow our population. And if there's one huge challenge over and above everything else, I think that's it in the province. And we really need, Ryan talked about policy, we really need some insight and direction and a policy of how we grow our population here in this province. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, that's going to be our success, along with all the resources we have and everything else we have. But we need to have a strong and vibrant population to grow our society.
Indeed, because who's going to be there to take care of us?
Exactly.
I think we need to grow up as a province. We need to become, there's one thing that Danny Williams said that I always liked, we need to become masters of our own destiny, period.
We have a little over 2 minutes left. Bottom line, if a young person was to come to you, Keith, and said, you know, I'm thinking about entering politics, what would your advice be?
Yeah, I would never say to somebody, no, don't contemplate entering politics, whether you enter at a municipal level, you know, at a provincial level, at a federal level. We need people to step forward, you know, understand what you believe in, you know, try and stay true to those values. I had a person tell me when I got into politics, Keith, don't change who you are. I tried not to do that. In times, there's pressures and forces within you within politics to do certain things you're not comfortable with. That's what I would tell people. Try and remain true to who you are. Don't change yourself. You know, once you can go into politics with friends and family. When you come out, you want those same friends and family. Politics is not going to be there forever. It's going to be a portion of your life, and you need to try and keep that in. You know, you'll have highs and lows. I have a former politician tell me one time, don't get too high, don't get too low. Just try and keep it level, and you'll do well. So I would encourage people to get involved, be true to themselves and who they are, and it can be rewarding.
Brian, would you agree with that?
I absolutely would agree with that. And I would also say that before going into politics, be it a younger person or whatever, you need a career first. You need to go out. You need to have a career, be in the real world, get a good understanding of how life works. And then once you make a decision, if you want to get into politics, because I find that from people from an early age, if they want to be politicians from the time they were in high school or whatever, that doesn't work out. They need a career first, and then they have to really figure out why do they want to be a politician? How do they want to make this a better place? You know, if it's their passion, how do you follow through on that passion? Make sure you have the focus.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, really interesting conversation. Thank you both for coming in this afternoon. I really do appreciate your time. We're going to hear from the Board of Trade tomorrow. They're going to be in to talk about how snowmageddon impacted businesses in the metro region and the 8-day state of emergency in the capital city. We'll be back tomorrow at 1.